Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
In the Marlon Brando movie, The Wild Ones, someone asked Brando, "Hey, Johnny, what are you rebelling against?" And Brando says, "What have you got?" Hi, I'm Mike Peskin for Brian Lehren. That, of course, is a great line of dialogue, but perhaps it's lacking as an organizing principle of a modern political party. And that's what Matt Bye says is wrong with the Democrats. They've got stances, they've got positions, they've got lots of things to be against. But what are the principles? What's the essential argument that they're making? The argument, Billionaire Bloggers and the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics, is the book. Matt Bye is a New York Times Magazine writer and the author of this book. Thanks for joining us, Matt.
Hey, Mike. Good to be here.
You put it a number of ways in the book. I think this was the best. You talk about a defense attorney or even a prosecutor. He could say, here was the body, here was the blood. But what he has to do is he has to have a theory of the case. He can't just talk about the individual facts. And that's what you're saying the Democrats don't have. They fail to offer a theory of the case.
That is, you know, a big part of the book. And let me tell you, a little bit about how I came to it, because this journey for me started back in 2003, really, back in the early part. I was out with Howard Dean when very few people had heard, much about Dean. And just being out in Iowa and seeing the crowds that he drew was really fascinating to me, because they were huge crowds, as you probably recall. They were young, they were old, some weren't even Democrats. And there was this huge fury, this sort of pent-up emotion, not just about Republican government, but at the direction of the Democratic Party and its inability, as they saw it, to really stand up to that. And I came back to Washington and said, something's going on at the grassroots of the Democratic Party that we really don't understand. And I spent really the next several years out with these, the aforementioned bloggers and millionaires and billionaires and folks from MoveOn.org and ground-level activists and labor leaders, connecting the dots of what I think is really the first political movement of the internet age, and that is this new progressive movement in Democratic politics. So the book is largely the story of how all these people who I call sort of oddly heroic characters in the introduction really, rose up to great prominence in a very short time and took a lot of power. And then it asks the question, okay, what when you look at the next 20 or 30 or 40 years, what is this movement about? How does it want to change government fundamentally beyond just rolling back the policies of the Bush era? And it's a question that I'm not the only one asking. It's a question that a lot of the people I followed and talked to are asking themselves as well. And that's really the story here.
And what are some of their answers? What are some of the best answers that you're hearing about what this party stands for?
Well, there, it's a very nascent point in the movement. I mean, I think there are, let me just to clear up, a couple of ways that this can be misperceived. I don't think there's a lack of principle. I think there are plenty of shared principles. I don't think there's a lack of ideas. I think there are plenty of policy ideas. What they're trying to figure out is what kind of iteration comes next for government. That is, if you have to meet a series of challenges now that are entirely different from the series of challenges you had to meet in the 20th century, does government need to change in some more fundamental way than simply layering on more programs or reversing policies that you don't like? And there are people, beginning to talk about this. MoveOn I document in the book how they try to come up with a positive agenda and think about a virtual think tank and to start this conversation. Andy Stern, who's the head of probably the most powerful labor union in the country, the service employees, and a really important figure in this progressive movement, gets up in front of the donors in one scene in the book, and he says, we are as far now from the New Deal as the New Dealers were from the Civil War. And I don't think Franklin Roosevelt looked back to Abraham Lincoln to figure out what to do about the Great Depression. And we have to stop talking about the New Deal and the Great Society as the only way we know how to govern. So this is these are people trying to provoke an important conversation, but I don't think they're yet at the point at this very early stage. We're really talking about a couple of years into a powerful political movement where they've begun to formulate what that argument is, nor are they really at a point where there's a consensus that such a thing is necessary.
Well, in the book, when Andy Stern makes that case, everyone applauds in the crowd, and then they quickly proceed to kind of miss his point and again start talking about tactics because they want to win the next election.
Yeah, he talks about it's an interesting scene because he gets up. It's in Austin, Texas. It's this big secretive meeting of donors of this group called the Democracy Alliance that I write a lot about. And he gets up and he says, look, he says that, as I point out about FDR. But then he says to them, look, there's a woman who cleaned your room and made your bed this morning in the hotel. It's a very posh hotel. Let's call her Maria. And he says, if the ideas we come up with for the next generation don't help Maria, because she's not going to get her health care from her employer anymore. She's not going to have the kind of security workers had at GM. We're looking at a whole new world. If we don't have an agenda that helps Maria, we're not doing our job. And there's a great deal of applause and enthusiasm for this. And then they break out into breakout groups, and I'm with one of the groups. And for about 30 seconds, the conversation is about how you help Maria. And then very quickly, almost imperceptibly, it changes to, well, let's send Maria this message. Let's tell Maria we're about her. How do we get Maria to vote for us? And it becomes immediately this tactical discussion about how you get the vote. But nothing has been achieved or discussed about actually why Maria is not going to benefit in the same way from sort of the policies of the last generation that workers of the last generation did. And that is the, you know, essential unanswered question. And really, the book asks questions. I don't have all the answers, but I think it's important to start that conversation.
Well, what do the Republicans say? How do they get Maria's vote, or John's, or Jim's? Or is it just their, slogan of lower taxes, less government, strong militaries, family values? Is that their Reagan-esque core belief system?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they're getting Maria's vote for the last several elections. Until now, they haven't needed it. The Republican answer to let me just step back a second. We've had underlying economic transformation. A lot of attention is paid to social issues in the country, but I think social issues, my feeling that I lay out in the book, is that social issues are sort of a close relation to some very transformational economic changes that make people very anxious and very scared. You know, people wanting to know what's happened to their communities, what's happened to their families, why are the jobs drying up, why are the schools no good? I mean, all of this is sort of an outgrowth of deindustrialization and a shifting economy that doesn't quite work off the same engine that we did for all those prosperous decades in the 20th century. So the conservative answer to this, because they were not the party of government for the vast majority of the 20th century, has effectively been to exploit those anxieties and to say, you know, the reason that you're feeling this way, the reason that you're anxious, is because Democrats have coddled poor people, and Democrats have tried to centrally plan everything, and Democrats have made a mess with their liberal government. And they had some you know, grains of truth to work off of, because if you've ever been in a public housing project, you know that not everything from the 20th century liberal agenda worked out exactly
as
planned.
Right. They had the combination of the myth of the welfare queen and the reality of what
and the reality.
Just said. Yes,
exactly. Sure. And so, it's been an easier haul for them in a sense, because they were the party outside power. And when you're the party outside power and people get scared and anxious, you've got a much easier case to make.
You spend your time in the wilderness. You put up Barry Goldwater. He gets trounced. You realize you have to come up with something, as opposed to hanging on to power, winning every couple elections, fooling yourself, I guess you would argue, fooling yourself into believing that you still have the intellectual relevance and wherewithal to go forward.
Yeah, but I wouldn't discount the idea agenda that Republicans had either, because I think this is too often done. You know, it makes people feel better to say, well, they never really had ideas. It was just about fear and hate.
Tricked us, or they're good at messaging, which is very popular.
Right. We get all of this. You get all of this. But in language and this and that. But, you know, they had a core agenda, philosophy that they worked off. It was very clear that the individual responsibility and the rights of the individual were central to growth and prosperity, that they had been trod over, and that in fact not only were those principles important at home, but that if you didn't stand up overseas and protect those principles for other people, it was impossible to live the way you wanted to live. And that, you know, that translated into lower taxes, less government, all the things we've heard about, and, you know, strong defense. And that was very powerful for them, because from that stemmed a lot of policy ideas that were considered very radical at the time they came out in the mid-1960s or so, and now today are part of sort of the mainstream conservative debate. Welfare reform was one, which Bill Clinton later came to embrace himself. Missile defense is another, which now is a perennially debated issue in the mainstream. I mean, there's a whole series of these. It does argue for is that you should put some intellectual and some financial resources into thinking about not just how to get your message across, but what you want to say and what you believe. There's no shame in having an argument about what you want to accomplish in government. And it's not that I think that progressives shouldn't be having the conversation about how to win. I understand why they feel that's critically important to the country right now. And it is. This coming election is critically important. But I think you can have more than one conversation at once. And if you don't start to have a conversation about how you would fundamentally change government, about what your argument is for adapting to new challenges in the way that previous generations have done so effectively and much to our benefit, then I think you're caught by surprise when you have power, because when you have power, you have to know what you want to do with it, and you have to know how to stay there.
Matt Bai is the author of The Argument, Billionaires, Bloggers, and the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics. We're talking to him on WNYC. So let's start with the billionaires. I think the bloggers get a lot of attention. I was very interested in the billionaires. They seemed like a tough nut to crack. They wouldn't always be open with you. And you talk about a group called the Democratic Alliance, which sprang forth from something called the Phoenix Group. Ooh, mysterious. I thought the Goblet of Fire was going to be intoned at one point or another. Who were these people? Who are these people?
Well, they, you know, it is. It's funny you describe it that way. It's because one of their the Democracy Alliance, a group of about 100 donors, who have now put over $100 million into trying to build what they call a progressive infrastructure, which is groups sort of that mirror or better the conservative movement outside the party apparatus. And one of their stated principles is transparency for government. They just don't think that transparency actually translates from government to them. They actually think that they should be able to operate entirely without scrutiny unless it's from the IRS. And I took great exception to this because my feeling is, you know, once if you're making widgets, go make widgets. But if you're trying to affect American politics, now you're on my turf and you have to answer some questions. There's scrutiny that comes with that. As far as I'm concerned, you know, if you're Oprah Winfrey and you want to go elect Barack Obama, be my guest. Every American should exercise whatever tools are there at their disposal to make the political change they want to make. But I think you have to answer questions when you're putting that kind of money into the political system, and they didn't want to do that. And so there was, you know, some tension that I go through in the book. But they're putting a lot of money in it, a lot of money into messaging and politics and voter files and all kinds of tactical pursuits that will probably make the party more effective in a short-term electoral way. But they have started out talking about idea generation, and there's actually been very little put toward those ends, even in the estimation of a lot of the partners themselves.
We're talking about the Soros, George Soros, who's the most famous, and then the Lewises, and there are some other quasi-household names there. Were these, well, you could get into who they are, but were these people who were giving thousands as much as they could give to the Democrats, and what the idea of the Democracy Alliance is, was to have a more organized way and a more targeted way for these people to spend their millions?
Well, it's an interesting thing, because that question gets into an issue of, you know, what motivates them, and most of these people were not, by and large, were not giving lots of money to the party and its candidates. And the reason is they were very disillusioned. There were a lot of Democrat donors, not just donors, a lot of core Democrats, probably a lot of your listeners. But in this case, since we're talking about wealthy Democrats, a lot of these donors kind of sat out the 90s. They were glad to have Bill Clinton. They were glad to have the White House. But the idea of centrism made them very uncomfortable. The idea of triangulation made them want to take a shower. They did not see themselves as Clintonian Democrats. And they kind of bit their lips and they said, well, this is what it takes to hold power, I guess. And then when Al Gore lost or was had the election taken away, however you want to look at it, and when John Kerry lost and they lost the Senate and they lost their margins, got even worse in the House, they got very angry and they said, you know, we were right all along. You have to stand on conviction. And this is the cost of Clintonian government as they saw it. And so they got together and there was a PowerPoint presentation done by a guy named Rob Stein. I go through it in the book. But this is it was sort of a very secretive PowerPoint that sort of detailed how much conservatives had put into organizations outside their own party structure. And they said, you know, we've got to step up and do something. So a lot of these are people who have not given before, but who are so furious at the direction of the party that they wanted to give money. And there's a scene in the book, I'm sure you probably remember, and I think it's a quite extraordinary scene where Bill Clinton actually comes before these donors, and it's a very nice exchange, and then he's questioned sharply on the war and on Hillary's stance on the war, and he really blows up. He just loses his temper. He says, you know, everything you've just said is wrong, wrong, wrong. Go ahead and do it, but you're going to do it and lose if you're going to eat your own in this party. You know, do it
if
and
you,
lose.
He
and,
says,
and,
if you want to hang a gold star on John Edwards for his mea culpa, go ahead, you're going to lose.
Right. He says, do it and lose, because he's a bunch. Right. And it's what it is, I think, is a moment, you know, Clinton is not a guy given to irate behavior. I think it's a moment where this frustration seethes out of him. He knows that these people are sort of, that this is a backlash against his legacy. He knows that these people have criticized his government. He does not believe that he's a compromiser. He does not believe that he governed without principle. And it eats at him. And I think in this moment, it sort of just comes out. And it's really an extraordinary moment, because it's the moment when the sort of progressive donors, you know, really clash openly with this great icon of the Democratic establishment.
Were you chronicling a specific type of donor, mainly people who are even a little further to the left than some of the ones that we think about, just like the bloggers are probably a little further to the left than the Democratic mainstream? Or are these where the big money is coming from to Democrats are actually people who aren't centrists?
Well, I was chronicling this group, so I wasn't chronicling party donors. That is, I think you have a few self-described centrists in this Democracy Alliance, but very, very few. I would say you would probably get fewer than 10 people who would describe themselves that way. There are you know, people involved who are also involved in, say, Third Way, which is a centrist organization here in Washington that's, you know, very influential on the Hill, and some of the donors, you know, there was an overlap there. But by and large, this group of donors, were more ideologically left and more frustrated at what they saw as the party's timidity on some of their core issues. There are lots of party donors who fall anywhere on that spectrum, but they did not tend to work outside the party structure.
But do you think the big money for Democrats is coming from that end of the political spectrum?
Absolutely. Yeah. The energy is complete. It's not just left, or it's hard to say left and center, because I think that's a little bit outdated. It's about being more confrontational and more absolute. And that is absolutely where the money is. And particularly on the West, by the way, I mean, this is a particularly West Coast phenomenon. It's not, there are of course pockets and strong elements of this in the East and in New York and in Washington and Boston, certainly. But particularly you see this in the Bay Area and Los Angeles. That is sort of the anchor point, and Denver too. That is sort of the anchor point for a lot of this new generation of donor.
Yeah, you have a lot of tech billionaires. You have entertainment types. One great scene in the book, which you write so well, and it's a very well-written book. You have Rob Reiner with his huge head, as you describe it, alternately snacking on slices of watermelon and cheese, screaming at you about how George Bush doesn't read a book.
You know, I've known Rob for a while, and I like him, and people said to me, I've gotten a lot of notes into the book saying you really cut up Rob Reiner. And I actually, you know, I don't have a problem. I'm not trying to be nice to Rob Reiner, but I have to tell you, I just describe him exactly as he is. I mean, he is kind of a larger than life, interesting figure who's given to rants and temper tantrums. And I describe, there's a few scenes with him in the book where I just pretty much lay out exactly what happened, and people seem to find it comical.
You know, okay, so a second ago we were talking about Hillary Clinton and what Bill Clinton said about John Edwards in the big Democrat running for president, who we haven't mentioned yet, is Barack Obama. And coming up after a break, we're going to play a segment of Barack Obama's recent speech on what he wants to do with Iraq. Matt, if you could stay around and comment on that, and we'll talk more about your book, okay?
I'd be glad to. Thank you, Mike.
All right. This is Mike Pesca in for Brian Lehrer, WNYC. We'll be back with that and your calls in a minute. Stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Mike Pesca on WNYC. We're speaking with Matt Bai, author of The Argument, Billionaires, Bloggers, and the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics. But Matt, I want to take a break for a second. And first of all, I want to solicit calls, because we've been talking a lot about are Democrats making an argument or just trying to win elections? So what you think the Democrats should be making, or if you think they are making a coherent argument and really have a set of principles, sort of like the New Deal or Reaganism. We're at 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-WNYC. But first, WNYC is trying to play extended selections of the candidates in their own words, not just these sound bites. We'll really let clips play for, you know, longer than a minute to really get a feel for the arguments they're making and how they're making it. And we'll go now to a speech that Barack Obama just gave in a town called Clinton, Iowa, of all places, about what he thinks should be done in Iraq. And let's hear some of that.
Our drawdown should proceed at a steady pace of one or two brigades each month. If we start now, all our combat brigades should be out of Iraq by the end of next year. Now, we will need to retain some forces in Iraq and in the region. We'll continue to strike at al-Qaeda in Iraq. We'll protect our forces as they leave, and we'll continue to protect U.S. diplomats and facilities. If, but only if, Iraq makes political progress and their security forces are determined not to be sectarian, we should continue to train and equip those forces. But we will set our own direction and our own pace, and that direction must be out of Iraq. The future of our military, our foreign policy, and our national purpose cannot be hostage to the inaction of the Iraqi government. Removing our troops is part of applying real pressure on Iraqis' leaders to end their civil war. Some argue that we should just replace Prime Minister Maliki, but that wouldn't solve the problem. We shouldn't be in the business, first of all, of supporting coups. And remember, before Maliki, we said that we just needed to replace the last prime minister to make everything all right. It didn't work.
And we are back now on the Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Mike Pesca talking with Matt Bai. Matt, since you wrote in your book, and Barack Obama is in your book, I want to know your reaction to that, or even maybe you want to say what you think the people that you chronicled, the billionaires, the bloggers, how are they reacting? How might they be reacting to that sort of proposal that Barack laid out?
Well, I think that is exactly the kind of thing, you know, they want to hear. And he knows that. Senator Obama has been against this war from the start, and I take him at his word. I think he's speaking from the heart, and he speaks very persuasively. He also knows that there's only one road for him to really, challenge Senator Clinton going forward in a serious way, and that is among these exact people I've written about, among the folks at the base of the party, the new progressive movement that really feels resentful and has great ambivalence about the Clinton years, and that's a tripwire out there for her. And if somebody can get her to step over it, it can create a lot of problems, because a lot of these people just don't want to go back to that time, but they see her as perhaps the most electable, the strongest candidate. And you mentioned, there is a place in the book where Obama sort of wades in and tries to deal with the blogs. He writes he's not happy at some of the attacks on his fellow Democrats, and he writes a piece called, I think it's called Truth, Tone, and Consequences in the Democratic Party. And it's this sort of 2,000-word missive that his aides beg him not to write, and then he puts online, he posts on Daily Kos, and he gets a lot of good responses, and then he just gets this wave of sort of negativity and attacks back at him. And when I talked to him about it, it really sort of depressed him. He seemed to feel as if it was just very hard to have a reasonable conversation about some of these things, because the people he was talking to really just wanted a party that did not brook a lot of dissent, that was very unified, and that was confrontational, and it wasn't so much about the substance of the issue. And so I think that experience taught him something. I think it's very much in his mind, and he knows that these are the voters he needs to reach, and Iraq is an absolute key pivot point for him to do that.
Simple statements that a Democrat, almost every Democrat, would make, such as we've got to work with Republicans, to a lot of the bloggers, those is fighting words.
Absolutely. And to a lot of the base, not just the bloggers. Yeah. I mean, because they feel that's how they got into this mess, and that's how they got into the Bush years, and that's how they got the policies they don't want. And so a lot of the things that people in government, people in Washington, accept as the realities of doing business day to day, don't translate well to the base. This is also in some ways, a coastal thing, only because the old party, which was governed by a lot of Democrats from Midwestern and Eastern cities and from the old South, they ruled for decades in Washington, and they came to see government very much as a give and take, and one hand washes the other. They're much more pragmatic. They have interest groups to satisfy. They have people to cut deals with, and that's what they do. Out west, where the sort of energy and population in the country has been moving steadily, San Jose replaces Detroit on the list of the top 10 cities, where they didn't have these same kinds of machines, and they were not prominent in that, sort of 20th century pipeline of ethnic urban machines up to Washington and the federal government. They've never really accepted that view. They've never really bought into it, and they're much more apt to want to stand on principle and much less given to sort of the niceties of governing.
The two superstars of the blogosphere that you spend a lot of time with are the guys behind MyDD and Daily Kos. The Marcos from the Daily Kos comes off as very opportunistic self-promoter. I think you like Jerome Armstrong. I don't know if a lot more, but you find him to be a deeper thinker. But you know what happens there is that Barack Obama, in that missive you were talking about, he engaged with them. And I think a lot of politicians just kind of look at how vitriolic a lot of the blogs are and say, why bother? They want 100% down the line, doctrinaire, anti-Republican rhetoric, and you just can't win with these people. Is that among the political class? I mean, is that a theory that there's really any counter evidence to? And is that important in terms of how politicians are going to be engaging with the bloggers?
Yeah, it's not just the political class, Mike. It's all of us. I mean, I'm going on Daily Kos this weekend to answer questions about the book and talk to people, and I will hear some insults that I've not heard in my interaction, say, with you on radio, it's a question for everybody who sort of does business in the political establishment of Washington and elsewhere. Is how you engage in a climate that can be a lot less civil and a lot less forgiving than what you're used to. And so Senator Obama's decision to go online and to actually talk to folks in the blog world was unusual. But, this is and there is some feeling in Washington that, maybe it's overblown. But, this is civic engagement. We ought not to forget how inspiring this is on some level, just because a few voices can sometimes make us think, wow, what a jungle, what a mess. I mean, I write in the book about a guy. I go to a move-on house party that he holds, this guy named Chuck in Virginia. And And I ask him why he's doing it. Turns out he's not a Democrat. He's not done this before. It's just that he lives across the street from this conservative activist, Brent Bozell, who's well-known in the conservative movement. And it makes him crazy. He's Googled the guy. He hates what he does. He can't stand to walk by the house. And his wife says to him, well, do something. And so he goes online and he joins MoveOn.org and he decides to have a party. And 60 people show up at his house and it's very successful. And you know, 5 years ago, there was no way for people like this to connect to politics. You certainly couldn't be heard. What were you going to do? Send a letter to your congressman and some intern was going to open it and send you a form letter. You were going to go to your local party meeting and they were going to have Robert's Rules of Order and they didn't know who you were and you were going to sit in the back row and do nothing. I mean, we have people now engaging in politics, making themselves heard. That's a terrific thing for the country, and we ought not to let, you know, a certain impression that comes across of a few people, you know, distract us from the notion that this is a revolutionary and inspiring phenomenon. And in the book, I'm very positive about that.
Do they hurt themselves with tone sometimes? This is something that you're hearing that, I mean, I think four different senators held up, many more referenced it, but four held up that Move On ad in the New York Times, Petraeus or Betrayus. And then you have protesters, these weren't a blog, but Code Pink, repeatedly interrupting the hearings. Do they do their cause a disservice with their strident tactics?
Yeah, at times I think they do. But are there journalists who do my profession a disservice at times with their work and their tactics? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have that. You know, I think in the case of Move On, which I write a lot about, obviously, and I've spent a lot of time with the leadership, you know, I think in the case of Move On, sometimes they get very focused on how to keep their membership enthusiastic and how to keep growing their list and getting donations, just like conservative interest groups have done. The NRA, you remember, they've gotten in trouble over the years for the same thing, you know, trying to play to the base. And I think what you learn in life and in politics, certainly when you write, you learn this, is that sometimes you can do something so over the top that you distract from the message you're trying to get out, which might be an important message. And I think that's what happened in this case.
Philip from New Haven is on the line. And I think that Philip, what point did you want to make about the book here?
I wanted to say a couple of things. You know, Will Rogers in the 1950s said, I don't belong to an organized political party. I'm a Democrat. And the fact that the Democrats haven't had a uniting sort of agenda, I don't think is really because of a lack of vision. It's because of what it means to be a Democrat. You know, it's easy if you're on the right to bang drums, you know, anti-abortion, it's murder. It's easy to bang that drum. Or we're going to lower taxes. Government is bad. It's not a, you know, it's not a we, it's a them. You can bang that drum. But if you have a nuanced opinion, if you look at situations in a historical context and wonder what the country stands for and where it's going, that kind of thought doesn't resolve easily into a kind of a one-line agenda or a series of one-line agendas.
Philip, we definitely get the point, and I'm sure it's something Matt has heard a lot, just that the phone line's so bad. But you have to hear this a lot. The Democrats are just so many more shades of gray. It's not as easy as it is for the Republicans.
Yes, you do. You absolutely hear Philip's point a great deal. And I think, you know, if Will Rogers, who's so often quoted by Democratic politicians, were to see the landscape today, he'd be pretty impressed, because I think they've gotten, the progressive movement in particular, has gotten a whole lot better about organizing and unity and message. I mean, I don't think Democrats have had any problem with that over the last 2 years. If anything, you know, there's too much unity. If anything, there's not enough debate intellectually, because of the concern is that, you know, tactically to win, you have to be unified. And I think that comes at some intellectual cost. I mean, I believe that politics turns on ideas. I think it always has in history and it always will. And I don't believe that people are too myopic or too focused on 30-second bites to care about ideas. I think that's that comes across in frustration. Mm-hmm. You feel that way. You think, gosh, we just can't get the message across. But I don't think that's the case. I mean, Bill Clinton, when he ran in 1992, for whatever else you want to say, had a very serious, clear argument, which really was that the economy had changed fundamentally and the people in power didn't understand it, that it was no longer an industrial economy, that it was moving into the information age, that it was displacing people and making them anxious, and that you had to sort of reassess government. You couldn't just keep going down the same old path. And for whatever reason, he had some limited success in government in pursuing that agenda, and for, you know, a lot of his own problems or because of his opponents, he didn't get as far as he wanted in some areas, and certainly did not get as far in convincing his own party of where it needed to go in the future. But I don't think anyone's ever accused President Clinton of lacking in nuance or not having, you know, deeply thought out intellectual positions, but I think he made a pretty strong argument for where government needed to go, and it wasn't where it had been in the past.
In your book, whenever you pose a question to the most prominent blogger, the Marco who's behind the Daily Kos, and whenever you ask him something like, so have you read Hayek, who's, of course, you know, probably the most important conservative thinker of the 20th century, he says no. You make the point that among the blogosphere, knowing anything before 1998 is really seen as not only irrelevant, but almost a mark of shame.
Yeah, because in their view, you know, largely in the view of the folks online, you know, the world has changed so dramatically that sort of, you know, and government became so corrupt and the Democratic Party so lost its direction that if you were involved before 1998, you kind of learned all the wrong lessons, right? And they're coming to this after the impeachment of Bill Clinton and taking away an entirely different set of lessons. You know, there is a sense that history isn't as important because history has changed, because technology has changed everything, and because people who get focused on the way things were done in the past, you know, will tend to keep reliving the same mistakes. And you know, Marcos would say to you, you know, Marcos says to me, look, I read every magazine that comes out. I don't really have to read books. I read tons of articles and intellectual articles, and I think that's true. But I think there's a value to knowing the history of politics, and one of the things you come away with if you know the history of politics is that it does turn on ideas and it does turn on intellectual capital much, much more often than it turns on how many doors you knock on.
And it's well known that among the bloggers there's tons of infighting and pettiness. I was surprised to see how much there was a lot of infighting among the billionaires, but just so much distraction with jargon and working groups and flow charts. How could these people make $1 billion if that's the sort of thing they spend their time with?
Right. I call it a nightmare condo association. Right? Well, I mean, part of what happened was a self-selection process where a lot of the donors who started the Democracy Alliance and who couldn't deal with the endless bureaucracy and committees and community building exercises just kind of left or checked out. They still gave money maybe, but they didn't stay involved. So the people who stayed involved had a lot of time on their hands, and it tended to get worse and worse. But the point I make in the book, and I think it's an important one and one that certainly many partners in the alliance, though not all or maybe not the majority, would agree with, is that what happens is when you don't know exactly what you believe, when you don't know what you want to achieve in government, you fill that void. This was actually not my idea. This was actually told to me by one of the donors who said, you know, when you don't know, when you don't have a clear litmus test, when you don't know what you're looking for, then you can't just give money to the causes. Then you have to sort of have this big, long process for figuring out where it should go.
Right.
And hence you get this, you know, growing bureaucracy. So it really was symptomatic of an intellectual problem at the core of the alliance, which was you had all this money and you wanted to win elections. But what was your vision for government? And then how do you go about achieving it? If you don't have the first, it's very hard to know the second.
I think you're right. And I think that, you know, if you look at a guy like Warren Buffett, who's not really a well-known Democratic donor or anything like that, he has a gut. He knows what he wants to do. And that's how he's able to make decisions in the business world, something like that.
That's how many of these people.
Yeah.
Right. It's how many of these people had made decisions in the business world. It's why they were wealthy.
Yeah. And they knew what they were talking about, and they didn't need PowerPoint presentations. They said, that makes sense. Here's whatever, $1 billion. There's one last thing I want to do. This book is called The Argument, and you are making an argument. And the argument is you need to stand for something. What? And, you know, the billionaires were a little lost. The bloggers were very much into tactics. But what did you learn from either of the groups? What did you learn about how to make your argument, either how to convince people, or how did you look internally to figure out what it is you wanted to stand for in this book?
Yeah, because it's an interesting question and not one I've had to answer, because I didn't start out thinking about this as a book called The Argument. There was no sense of even the word argument where I start. I really just wanted to follow this movement and see where it went and see what the point of it was. And sort of slowly, even as I began to write, I didn't quite know. And then as I put it more and more down on paper, I began to feel as if this was a central theme running through it. And I think, you know, what I learned about this was that I wasn't the only one asking this question. I mean, what really interested me was the way in which there are so many really bright, creative people in this new progressive movement, the people who run Move On, some of the bloggers, some of the donors, Andy Stern, who I mentioned earlier, even Howard Dean and I, who have talked about this at some length at different times, that there are a lot of people trying to think this through. It's not like no one cares. And so I think it's a really important conversation to have, because while it may anger some people and they say, look, I've heard enough about why Democrats don't know what they want to do with government, you know, we figure we've heard all before. In fact, it's something that the real leadership, at the smartest people in this movement, want to talk about, and sometimes have trouble getting their own followers and their own folks to talk about. And it doesn't mean you have to abandon abandon all the other conversations you're having. It doesn't mean you can't win, but it just means that you might have to have a sometimes contentious conversation about where you're going to go in the future. And I came away with a lot of respect for a lot of the people I was writing about, because I think they are deep thinkers, and they are trying to figure out what the future should look like for their movement and for their country.
Matt Bai, author of The Argument, Billionaires, Bloggers, and the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics. Thanks very much, Matt.
Anytime, Mike. Thank you.